This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
And I don't want to keep you because I know you have a pressing engagement with a fella across the street from me who wants you to go and look at his balcony.
Yes, indeed.
What happened there?
Well, I don't know. I struck up conversation with him.
We popped into a cafe across the road and Ed was lagging slightly behind and all of a sudden heard him shout, "Nice balcony!" And I thought, that is some quality small talk.
It's true. Anyway, then they came down to your Bijou cafe and said to me, you know, could you come up and have a look at our balcony?
So what, you're going to go and declare it officially open?
I'm looking at a sponsorship arrangement with the balcony, actually.
How is, before we get into reasons to be cheerful and what's coming up, your week been well? We saw each other the other day. We had fun. We went for a walk in the park again.
We did. Arm in arm.
Yeah.
There were some unsuspecting people who we had a photo with from Cornwall, didn't we?
Ed hears some people giggling behind him because they've spotted him. And you say, hi.
Well, maybe they were just giggling and went up to them and said, you know, perhaps you'd like a photo.
Well, this is it. A lot of famous people moan about people asking them for photos. Ed asked them if they would like a selfie. And they were kind of... Yeah, it's partly,
you know, if I'm honest about it, to make a quasi-serious point, it's partly when people are sort of nudging each other about the fact that it's me, I'd sort of in a way prefer to talk to them.
Mm.
You know, do you know what I mean? It's sort of slightly, but it feels slightly like you're in a kind of weird middle distance sort of situation, you know.
Well, I thought you handled it very well. I think I did see one of them deleting it straight afterwards.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. But there was a slight, let's just be sort of full disclosure, there was a slightly awkward moment where it wasn't quite clear whether you were going to be in the picture or not in the picture.
So not only did Ed kind of force the idea of having a selfie on them, then I ended up in it. And they're thinking, who is this hairy man?
I think Alex, who works for me, said, oh, you know, perhaps you'd like Jeff in the picture. And then it was sort of all slightly like...
Not really.
You know, it was kind of, but then I kind of included you. I sort of encased you in a warm sort of glow of selfie.
You clasped me to your comely bosom.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Should we talk about what's coming up? We're talking culture this week.
We're talking about culture. This, as we speak, we're recording on the day when the new City of Culture for 2021 is going to be announced. That's not the European City of Culture, which we've been excluded from because of the whole Brexit business. It's the UK City of Culture. This was actually an initiative that Andy Burnham took when Labour was in government. And, this year it's Hull. And we're going to be talking to somebody from Hull about the effects that they've had this year from being the City of Culture. We're going to be talking to Dave O'Brien from the University of Edinburgh, who studies these issues. And then we're going to be talking... also to the brilliant, amazing cultural icon, Grayson Perry. I love him. He's great.
So exciting.
And that's very exciting.
And as well as that, we have comedian Helen Monks coming on to pitch her ideas of things which could be reasons to be cheerful. If you remember, Catelyn Moran had the sitcom based on her own life, Raised by Wolves, and Helen, in effect, played Catelyn in it. So that's all coming up later. Shall we do reasons to be cheerful?
Yeah, what's yours?
My reason to be cheerful is yesterday...
All your troubles seem so far away.
Well, yeah, there is a link, actually.
Yeah.
I do a show for American Radio about the Beatles, and I will interview different people about their favourite Beatles
Can people
songs.
Listen to it online? Presumably they can.
Yeah, I think they need to subscribe.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's on Sirius XM in the States.
Okay.
But I got to interview a national treasure about the Beatles yesterday, and what's more, I got to go to his house and do it, and it was none other than former Python Michael Palin.
How fantastic.
It was just great. And, you know, there are certain people who you just won't say a bad word about, David Attenborough. I mean, I know you will because you have problems with the Blue Planet podcast.
No, they've
beating
gone
out
down.
And,
they've gone down.
Oh, so you're fine with Attenborough fine. Again. Yeah, your beef with Attenborough is over.
Yeah.
But Michael Palin, I think, is very much in that category. And part of me was a little apprehensive thinking, oh, my God, what if it's just all an act for the cameras? And he could not have been nicer. He was so wonderful. Went round his beautiful house, made his cup of tea and told fantastic stories about George Harrison. He said George Harrison was a great one for giving him gifts. So one time they'd been out for a boozy meal at a pub, and at the end of the meal, George Harrison gave him one of his Oscars. Like the Beatles won an Oscar for A Hard Day's Night or whatever it would have been. And he just gifted Michael Palin his Oscar. And then some other time they were round at George's
house.
Did
you get the hint that if you've got more than one award, it's good to give the award away to someone who recently didn't win an award.
I've told you.
I got my certificate for coming second. That arrived
this week. I'll get the Dymo label maker and I will put your name on one of the awards. How does that
sound? Excellent, excellent.
He told
me. I went through such a business with Michael Palin to arrange that with him that he would like say to you this story about the Oscar. He'll say, he was going to say, did he say you do this podcast with Ed? Blah, blah.
He was very subtle.
Anyway, George Harrison gave me this Oscar.
He was trying to show, not tell. What's your reason to be cheerful?
So my reason to be cheerful relates to our subject for today. My son, I'm going to be shortly hot-footing it to go and see my son Sam in the school production of The Tempest. Now, Sam is only 7, so I think it's pretty amazing that they're doing The Tempest.
That is incredible. I know. Yeah.
I mean, I don't quite know what to expect, but I'm looking forward to it.
Are you a stern critic?
No. Definitely not.
In fact, you're not a pushy stage father?
I'm just sort of happy middle way. In fact, he had a concert the weekend where he was playing the ukulele. They were playing Jingle Bells. Oh, maybe you could teach him the ukulele.
I can't play it. I got a couple of them, but I don't know what to do with them.
And so that was good. They played Jingle Bells and they did it nicely. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking forward to The Tempest.
And what is he in The Tempest?
I think he's a narrator.
Okay. That's quite a serious thing to be doing. That's a good thing to be doing, right?
Yeah, I think there's lots of narrators.
Less impressive.
I think it's fine.
I'm not sure.
He didn't seem to have any sort of impending stage fright when I talked to him about it this morning.
Were you in school plays and stuff?
I was in school plays in primary school. I always felt a bit discriminated against because when I went to secondary school, it was all people who could sing. They're musicals. And I just thought, I can't sing.
Mm.
So I kind of never, it sort of slightly rankles with me, actually. I sort of slightly regret not doing it, but I really enjoyed doing the school plays when I was in primary school.
Well, maybe, I know we've mentioned Panto before on the podcast.
Well, you think I might have a new career in Amdram?
So don't rule it out. I was going to tell you about a school play I was in. Now, this was in the mid-80s. So bearing in mind, I went to a comprehensive school and it was during the Thatcher years. I don't remember anything about this play, but somebody put the programme up on Facebook. So I can see that I played a character called Sogat.
Wow, which was a trade union.
Funny you should say that, because the main character is King Codian of TUC. There's a Princess Equity, a Prince Aslef, and a Baron Nalgo.
Like my kind of play.
Do you think the teachers were trying to make any political points at all?
No, it sounds entirely sort of non-political and impartial. That is extraordinary. I think there is one other sort of non-thespian, well, it is thespian, reason to be cheerful for this week, which is I sort of feel that the sort of whole podcast should have ownership of this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the incredible success of your wife Sarah with her comedy routine from some years ago, which got posted and then went viral this week.
Yeah, she's had 500,000 hits.
Amazing.
Which is more than we've had this week. So she's
about the joint custody that she has with your ex-wife of your dog.
Yeah, ex-girlfriend. Very clear to make the distinction.
Yeah.
Yes. But
it is very funny.
She's very funny.
She is very, very talented.
Yeah, so we can put a link up to that on the Facebook page too.
We can, definitely.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
All right, and we're thrilled to be joined by National Treasure, I think.
That's my official status now, yes.
But that's a fast track. I mean, National Treasure often takes decades and you've done it in far less than that, so you're a high achiever.
I was a late starter. I didn't really get going until I was well into my 40s, and I'm now 57, so...
It's Grayson Perry. Hello.
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 So we're talking about...
And Kevin is here.
Oh, Kevin the cat.
Kevin the cat is here.
We should perhaps tell this story, because Kevin made front page news in London yesterday, and Ed, you were embroiled in this story.
Well, I was talking to Grayson about this podcast, and Grayson said that I said, "Well, I gather you've lost your cat," and he said, "Yeah, I mentioned it to the Evening Standard." I said, "You're on the front page of the Evening Standard," and I took some time to convince him that he was actually on the front page of the Evening Standard, owing to the fact that there were one or two other things going on at the moment, like sort of Brexit disaster and so on. I think Grayson might have thought it was sort of unlikely that he'd be on the front page.
I also had a vision of sort of Evgeny Lebedev sending kind of special agents out searching for it so he could get the follow-up story, you know, with George Osborne in tow.
That is true.
but Kevin is unscathed.
He's got a bit of a broken tail, I think, because he was stuck on the roof next door for 3 days. So, I think he's definitely affected by it. Oh. He's mooching about.
But that's a reason to be cheerful.
Definitely.
The return of Kevin.
Well, cats do power the internet.
Yeah, I love nice pictures of cats. And Kevin is a particularly nice cat, if I may say so.
He does all the cat things good.
Yeah.
So we're here to talk about the effects of culture on regeneration. And I wanted to start by thinking about when you were growing up in Chelmsford. Were you aware of a local culture?
Ooh, golly, no, not really. I don't think I really went into a museum until I was about 6 or 7, and I went to the British Museum with my mother.
So that was coming up to London to see that?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of a local culture.
And she decided to take you, did she?
Yeah, I think it was a sort of compensation package after my parents got divorced, I think, and we were all in it. So I can remember like my auntie coming, and it was a big day out in London. We went to the British Museum.
And what did it have an immediate effect on you?
Disappointment, I think. I remember I was in the lift, and the lift man, they had a lift attendant in those days, and he said, "Where would you like to go?" And he said, "What do you like?" And I said, "Oh, I like models." And he said, "Oh, they've got some models in the Egyptian department." So we went into the Egyptian department. There's like these quite rough model ships. I was dead disappointed. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
But you
I got my revenge.
Yeah.
He said, "I've got a trustees meeting this afternoon."
I hope you're improving their model for other 6 and 7 year olds.
So do you think if people grow up in somewhere like London where culture's all around them, they're at an immediate advantage because of that?
I suppose it does seep into you, though I think London is full of people who are proud to live in a city full of theatres they don't go to.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Why is he looking at me when he says that?
Because, you know, I think it adds a luster to a place that if it's got a strong cultural reputation, even if the people who are proud of it don't go to it. But, you know, culture operates in an interesting way, I think. It's because it's more subtle. It puts over more ambiguous messages. It delivers messages in a way that, you know, giving speeches and the traditional media can't do. Because it's a sort of a whole body experience very often, you know. We are human beings and, you know, music and dance and drama and visual art, all these things are speaking to different parts of us that, you know, the normal political messages we hear, they're not delivered in the same way. You know, what's great about culture, it goes under the radar. You know, it's soft power. And so, you know, often when we talk about the sort of instrumentalization of culture, it seems to me that that's one aspect of it that isn't sort of talked about much. It's the fact that in this age when truth and facts, you know, there is a difference between truth and facts. Facts are a bit, you know, dull. They're like 2 and 2 equals 4. Whereas truth is something that people emotionally engaged in. It has a sort of revelatory aspect to it. And culture is a really good way of delivering that, sort of with narratives, gets people engaged. And so I think that, you know, when we talk about the use of culture in
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Grayson, but Kevin has come and sat on my lap.
I must admit, I'm now falling in love with Kevin.
Like a James Bond buddy, the way you're stroking him.
There you were making a really kind of profound point
about truth.
I've actually come to kidnap Kevin. This is basically all a ruse.
Hey, he's brilliant. Well, you know, he's trained. He's media trained. I'll tell you that.
Exactly. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, truth. That's my life's work. You know, it's all been eclipsed by the bloody cat, you know. You know, trying to widen participation in serious culture. Don't mind. Let's just put a picture of a fucking cat on the front page.
What was your first, and this is probably a strange question, but what was your first cultural experience? What was that? You had the British Museum, but it was disappointing. What was the first experience of where the light really came on for you?
You see, I come from an era, I think, you know, I'm 57. I come from an era where, for me, a lot of the people that went to art school, it was about the doing of it. And so the cultural experience was in the doing. You know, I enjoyed drawing, I enjoyed painting and making things. And that's what led me, you know, to enjoy the art lessons and then go to art school. I never went really to a contemporary art exhibition until I was, you know, well into my teens, probably 16 or 17. And it wasn't like, oh, I want to be one of them. It was, I like doing this that I'm doing, and I'm going to just continue doing it. And so there wasn't this idea that I was, you know, communicating to an audience. It was very much, I'm an insular kind of, like, I could have got on with it in my bedroom like some outsider artist and just carried on happily, I suppose. The idea that I was joining a field of culture that had a traditions and an audience was alien to me until I went to art school.
What was the first thing that you did? What was when you said you were doing stuff, what was it?
Well, I started with just drawing on scraps of paper and little books like all kids do, you know, and then I really, really enjoyed the art lessons at school when I used to do extra art lessons. And then my art teacher just said, I think you'll do really well at art school, because he could see my unconscious sort of bleeding out onto the page.
Right.
And then, you know, I went to art school, and that's when you get the shock of, oh my God, you know, the art, it just suddenly explodes, the idea about what art could be. And then, you know, I started going to galleries, and then, you know, then I came to London after art college, and you sort of just join in with youth culture and what's going on, you know. And I think why culture is important in a good way is that you don't have to think, I am now doing culture.
Yeah.
It happens to you, you know, and whether it's the sort of village dance, or whether it's going to the grandest theatre or gallery, it's something that seeps in. Watching the telly, people never talk about television. This really annoys me as someone who makes television. They never talk about television as culture. And I think
it's looked down upon.
Yeah, when people go on Pointless, you know, and they say, what do you do? Oh, I'm a politician. Yeah, what do you do in your spare time, Ed? Oh, I sit in front of a telly.
Yeah.
Nobody says that.
Yeah.
And yet that's what they do, you know. And I think, you know, some of the most profound and educating and moving things that I see on a daily, weekly basis are on the television. And it's a great, and it's especially in this country, a lot of the time, what the power of culture, you know, people put this sort of capital letters on it as, you know, going to the opera or going to the Tate Modern or something. And yet, you know, there's lots of things. I mean, the internet is full of culture. You know, the number of people now that, you know, are very funny or witty or observant and clever on social media.
I do agree with that.
And, you know, the amount of inventiveness, you know, that they write these sort of hilarious haiku in 140 characters, now unfortunately 280 characters, you know. And I think it's a joy, you know. I'm constantly...
You mean like Donald Trump, basically? Not him.
No.
Now, how should we think about this issue of sort of regeneration, culture, or maybe more widely, what can culture do for a place?
I think, you know, culture is what makes anywhere worth living for. You know, that it's the bits you do when you're not kind of getting on with the utilities of life, in a way.
Yes.
And I think that the power of culture, because everybody, you know, is looking around in the cultural landscape for things that validate their experience, if you see what I mean. So the other day I was on the stage and doing a lecture, and I happened to know that it was the 40th anniversary of the broadcast of Abigail's Party, right?
Yeah.
One of my favourite plays. And I just mentioned this to the audience, and they just burst into a round of applause for this anniversary. And I thought, that's because, you know, they're my age, and it kind of resonates with them, you know, because they saw their culture validated in that moment, you know. And I think that everyone is doing that all the time. They're looking for their very ambiguous sort of churning interior experience to be reflected in culture. And however that is, you know, whether that's a rap song or whether that's a sort of political play or whatever. And I think that makes them feel part of the, you know, the society they're in.
There's something interesting in what you're saying, though, in that we're talking about culture and place. And the big two things that you've mentioned are television and the internet, which are completely removed from the local. Do you think people are becoming more removed from local culture?
Well, I think the nature of, you know, the media now being global is that it can operate like a kind of blender, you know, in that now if you sort of wear a different T-shirt in kind of Stoke-on-Trent, the next minute someone in the Philippines is sort of mass-producing it. I don't know. And I don't know. It has a good and bad effect, but I think you can't ignore electronic media and the way that it has, the reach it has. And, of course, people now are used to seeing the best. Who's going to go down the pub and listen to some slightly shonky folk band when they can just turn on their phone, put on their earbuds and hear the best music in the world, their absolute favourite?
And, you know, if you think about the sort of last 20, 30 years, I would say, as somebody who's a relative ignoramus about these things, we have seen, you know, it's been a great time for culture in this country. And it's also been a time when, from the Angel of the North to the ideas of City of Culture, we have seen culture outside London really, certainly in some places, thrive.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, you get, say like the, you know, the gallery in Margate, you know, exactly. The Turner Gallery exactly. In Margate, and the Hepworth in exactly. Wakefield and pieces. There's also been a few white elephants as well, you know, yeah. Because I think there was a big enthusiasm of spending lottery money on galleries, hoping that, you know, that would have this instant effect on the house prices. I remember literally hearing Nick Sirota make a speech quite a few years ago now.
Now the chairman of the Arts Council, formerly director of the Tate, yeah?
Yes, saying crime has dropped, you know, since this gallery opened or something. And I actually did a pot called This Pot Cuts Crime by 29%, you know. And so I can remember feeling quite sceptical of that kind of march of the cultural tanks across the lawns of England. Sometimes it's taken off. I think a big problem is that often they set these things up and then they forget they've got to have exhibitions and artists in them, you know, and there's only so many.
So it's a building without content or not enough content.
They've got to have a program.
Yeah.
You know, and when you've got a dynamic, well-informed, curator or director of these places, then they work, and that's where they live or die by, I think.
Is there a sort of good way of doing it and a bad way of doing it? I mean, in other words, are there places where you think, well, they've understood the role that culture can play in a place? They've encouraged it, nurtured it. It's helped the area, but it's not been a sort of, you know, the planet culture's arrived. I mean, is a place you might, because you've gone around the country, done a lot, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's when...
like Margate, for example.
Yeah, Margate is interesting because I think that, you know, that part of Kent has been very run down. It's starting to get gentrified now because it's sort of like easy commuting distance of London. But I think there was kind of a negative reaction to the turn in contemporary, you know, because it sort of plonked there on the thing.
Right.
And I think that it was seen as an attempt of sort of, to sort of brazenly attract middle class house buyers to the area, and you know, and the hipsterification of the sort of an area around the art gallery. But in the end, you know, these things take a while. I think that people think it's going to happen instantly, but social change happens at a much slower pace. You know, you've got to let it bleed in and say, oh, yes, it's quite nice there, you know. Now, I went to Southend recently, you know, a place I used to go as a kid, and it was starting to, oh, it's quite nice. It's quite nice along here now. And I remember it being rough.
And is culture been a part of that?
Well, it has got, I mean, there's two contemporary art galleries in Essex, and one of them is in Southend. I'm not crediting it.
Sure, sure. But the whole idea of cities of culture, we're talking as the 2021 City of Culture for the UK is about to be announced. That idea has been a good thing. Do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think
Hull is, you know.
Yeah, I went to Hull and everybody was, you know, very, very happy with it and the feeling. And I think it's 9 out of 10 people who live in Hull have been to some event or something in the culture, and it puts the place on the map. And I wonder, you know, I'm so doubtful about it. To sort of what are they after? You know, are they after higher house prices? Are they after attracting investment? You know, because nowadays there's an industry in place branding. You know, and so, you know, a city that's on its uppers or wherever, and all over around the world, there's specialist consultants who'll come in there and they're almost like very diligent tourists, and they'll look at, see how the people dress and what the graffiti says and what the local museum has got in it. And they'll sort of like try to give it a cultural identity, you know,
yeah.
sort of. And I suppose they're trying to sell it to investors and potential residents and tourists. But you sort of wonder how much in the end, you know, all these places that often in Britain are the casualties of industrial decline. Is there ever going to be enough sort of energy of a different sort that's going to regenerate them? You know, what are these cities for now? I sort of ask sometimes.
How do you communicate to people in existing communities that this is for you too? It's not just to attract people into these areas. Because growing up, I would just have an innate sense of, oh, those things aren't for people like us.
I think the media is, you know, important in that, you know, I've seen, you know, my personal experience is that doing television, you know, has had a huge knock-on effect on my art gallery visitor figures, and it's making people feel like they understand what's going on and know it, and
taken you to new audiences. Actually.
Yeah, but I've also, you know, I've also communicated what I'm about.
Yes,
in a way.
Yes.
That is interesting without being patronizing. Yes. And I'm often dealing with quite subtle, sophisticated philosophical ideas, you know, around gender and identity and class. And yet I'm putting it over in an entertaining, engaging way. And I think that often, you know, a lot of culture, the high end culture is sort of like, they're people talking to themselves, you know, they're talking to other people who have as a rarefied taste of culture as they do. And I think that one thing you can't do if you're kind of trying to talk to a large audience is sort of fake it in a way. It's almost like you have to be of the audience yourself. You know, I am just myself when I'm doing my thing. And I'm lucky in that I have a kind of demotic, broad appeal. You know, I always say to my audience, I share your taste. You know, and it's not like I've reached down, I've just reached across.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if you're someone who only likes constructivist opera, then yeah, talk to those people, but they're going to be limited. You know, the artists often I find that I love are the comedians, you know, because they are incredibly instinctual and they speak to a broad audience. Yeah, I think we've really got to get this idea about what is culture is this sort of difficult thing that you have to learn about. You know, that actually you start
too much eat your spinach, in other words.
Yeah, start with people saying, no, you know, chips are culture too, and get them to sort of think about it. And people are more, I think once you've got them on your side, you know, they're much more. I mean, I get all sorts of interesting people who meet me in the street and say, oh, I really like what you do. And I'm really shocked. I mean, the other day I was on my push bike. I stopped at a sort of temporary traffic lights. And the guy who was digging the road sort of popped out of the hole and said, shouldn't you be in a dress?
Like, brilliant.
And I thought, yes, but you know, I've got a broad audience here, you know.
There's this thing you said about culture and regeneration, which I thought was very, very interesting. You said, if you think of artists, they're like the shock troops of gentrification. We march in, we're the first people to go, we like this old warehouse, yeah, we need a cheap studio. And people start noticing, you know, and maybe some designers open up a little boutique, and suddenly before you know it, the dead hand of the developer is noticing it, and before you know it, the designers move in, and that's it, bang goes the area.
Yeah, that's totally, and I've seen it happen, you know, all over London places, they become cultural deserts, they become sort of investment property opportunities for very wealthy people, and
that's the crux of the dilemma, isn't it? How do you have, you know, how can culture, because cultural revival of areas, and I'm not saying the culture isn't there, but it might be more latent. Bringing it out, giving it voice, giving it space is really important. Bringing people in from elsewhere is not a bad thing. I mean, people visiting and so on, but not making it so it just pushes out.
I think it's a difficult dance nowadays because of the nature of the internet. The minute something becomes noted as a thing, everything has to become a thing now, you know. And so the minute a cafe is like, wow, that's a really good cafe there, you've got a queue of Japanese tourists outside of it who've looked it up on TripAdvisor or whatever, and it sort of killed it as a thing in a way. And it's because if you think about, you know, a lot of the culture, say, of around popular music in the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s, it was quite a slow burn. You know, mods, for instance, started in the late 40s, but didn't really kind of hit the headlines until the 60s.
So everything is instantaneous now.
But now, yeah, exactly. It would happen in a matter of days rather than a matter of years. And so I think that we've got there's this feeling that it's all much more self-conscious now. It's, oh, let's do some culture, and how are we going to pitch this to make it look authentic? You know, because if you can fake authenticity now, you know, you're onto a winner, yeah. Because that kind of tone is what people were all searching for, which goes back to that idea of, you know, a sort of blurry shot on your phone will get more clicks than a sort of highly focused professional shot. People want the grit. You know, that's why the idea of the underground, they have some ownership over it, I think, is an important thing.
Kevin's now attacking Ed. He's turned on you. He's a floating voter.
Exactly.
Oh, he's a Tory.
The title of this podcast is Reasons to Be Cheerful, and there's obviously lots of reasons to feel pessimistic about the country at the moment. But do you feel cheerful about the cultural life of the country?
Yeah, no, I do. And I think that as a whole, you know, if you kind of got a bunch of, you know, 10,000 people in the cultural industry in a room and asked them which way they voted, you know, they're a progressive bunch. They're a progressive liberal bunch,
yeah.
Which of course is great. But I think the downside of that, and often when I'm sat at a dinner next to a curator, I say, oh, when's your next Tory show you're going to put on? You know, and I say, you know, all these galleries, they're always making big play about diversity. You know, we're going to show this group and this group and this group in our gallery, which is great. I say, but when do you represent the Tories? When do you represent kind of plonking Daily Mail, Middle Britain? You know, they don't. And so,
exhibition. You think we should have the Paul Dacre exhibition?
People just want to see oil paintings of ships and horses?
Well, maybe they do, and maybe that's, you know, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe why shouldn't they put on exhibitions of ships and horses in the gallery instead of like difficult stuff about social issues? You know, because, you know, I'm the coordinator, the kind of the head honch on the Royal Academy Summer Show next year, and. You know, the great thing about that, I'm making a big play about it, it's democracy. You know, it's about that it is a show where you're going to see the big names of contemporary art next to Joe Bloggs, who's sort of done a watercolour of Dartmoor, you know, and I think that's fantastic. And I think that, you know, as Brexit showed us, the referendum, the liberal progressive bubble, you know, have gone from that. You know, I often think that they all sort of walk along thinking they're still on the Aldermaston march with a, you know, college scarf, and they're sticking it to the man. And of course, what they've found out post Brexit is they are the man, you know. And I think that it's been a bit of a shock to the progressive liberal metropolitan bubble that, you know, there's a big chunk of the country out there, the people perhaps that need to, you know, be represented culturally, who see us as the problem.
And do you think the 6 or 7 year old of today, compared to Grace and Perry when you were 6 or 7, there's more cultural opportunity for that 6 or 7 year old today? Would you say?
If they're prepared to search it out, yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's easier to search it out now.
Yes, what I mean, because, you know, you just pick up your phone and you can Google something and find it out, and it's feeling culturally entitled that's your thing to do. You know, I'm imagining that a lot of kids in sort of deprived parts of the country, they don't even have a dining table to sit around, let alone sit around talking about culture, because it's led from your, you know, home environment, probably, in that, you know, if you're talking, you know, around the dining table about it, then you pick up that habit and that way of thinking and engaging. Whereas, you know, when I did a program with a group of sort of disenfranchised young men in Skelmersdale, you know, some of them hadn't ever been to Liverpool, which was 20 miles away, you know, and I was sort of amazed at it. But they just didn't have that was not on their horizon, literally. So to engage with culture, you need to kind of learn to engage with culture in a way and know that it's there. I mean, I think I put my daughter off going to art galleries because I dragged her to so many, you know, and it's taken.
My mum dragged me to quite a lot, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but I think, you know, now she's older, she's come back to it. But the cultural industry needs to sort of think about how it, not necessarily what it's saying, but how it says it, the tone of it, where it says it, and to get the reach to as wide an audience as possible, you know, because, and for them to feel included in it.
Grayson Perry, cultural icon, owner of Kevin, for which you're even more famous today. Thanks so much.
So to get a perspective on what becoming a city of culture can do for a place, we're now joined by Sharon Darley from the Goodwin Trust in Hull. And of course, Hull is the UK City of Culture this year. Sharon, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. Hi.
Tell us, first of all, what's been the impact of Hull becoming the City of Culture in 2017?
At the risk of sounding repetitive, I think I'm going to repeat what a lot of people are saying at the minute, that it's been absolutely amazing.
Tell us a little bit about what the impact has meant in practice. How would you describe it as you go around Hull and do your work with the Goodwin Trust, which is a charity that actually helps local people and works in partnership with the community?
It has had impact across the city, I will say, I think. I think the Hull 2017 team have worked hard to get out of the city centre. I work on an estate pretty close to the city centre, actually. We would be classed as an inner city estate. However, we're still quite isolated. One of the projects we did for the City of Culture, the I Wish to Communicate with You project, was based on that very theme, that isolation, that, hi, here we are, we're okay, we want to talk to people, come and see us. It was that sort of communication. So I don't think it matters whether you're right next to a city centre or on the edge of a city, you can feel isolated. And I think they worked hard to get into those communities, because the city's made up of micro communities.
If you're one of the people on that estate, how might you have experienced the City of Culture through the projects that the Goodwin Trust has been organising?
Goodwin runs its own arts programme called Estate of the Nation. Well, we feel it's quite innovative because we've been embedding artists into our community for quite a few years now. And we've had some really good results. It's been a joy, actually. And we've done lots of other things. We have our own theatre company called Middle Child, who are doing really well now. We already were doing lots of work. And so when City Culture came, it gave us opportunity to put in a couple of bids for a couple of ideas that we really wanted to do and we really felt would make a difference. The first one was I Wish to Communicate with You. One of the artists that came and lived on the estate for a year was Silvio Palladino. And while he was there, did some work on this idea as a concept of putting coloured lights into existing lighting in communal areas in blocks of council housing. We'd done the consultation and I'd seen the looks on people's faces. It was such a beautiful idea, using coloured filters in existing lights. We've ended up lighting up 10 blocks now.
Fantastic.
It includes about over 1,000 people, roughly.
Fantastic. And what was your other project?
The other project was Terrace Enders, which was, we worked with the One Show, the BBC One Show, and we put a mural up of Lillian Bellocca on the estate. It was all last minute and wonderful.
Who was the mural of, sorry?
Lillian Bellocca. Lily changed the whole health and safety rules back in the 60s fishermen.
Oh, right. Fantastic.
So she's a local hero, and it was done in the traditional gable end way, and we did that. It was wonderful and very successful. And then so we put in another bid called Terrace Enders to do two more murals on the heart of the fishing industry, you know, which is a big part of Hull's heritage and memory.
Definitely.
And so we did that, and that had quite a big impact on quite a lot of people. And then we held a traditional block party. Local people got on stage and performed, local kids, very multicultural, loads of positive stuff. It's just opened up all sorts of communication on all sorts of levels, I would say.
And as a resident of Hull more generally, would you say the the city feels different as a result of this?
Yeah, I do. So you're preaching to the converted. I am one of the engaged. Arts and culture changed my life in loads of different ways. I went to art college and I always knew that arts and culture makes a difference to people's life. My job title at Goodwin is quality of life. That's my job title.
Yeah.
And I know, because I've seen it over and over again in all sorts of circumstances, that contact and to be emerged in any form of arts and culture, and I'm not a snob, I think sitting down and watching EastEnders or Corrie is a form of engaging with culture. Everything, you know, we're engaged with culture all the time. I think it improves quality of life. I think it improves people's perceptions of where they are, and it's done that here. I think it's done that here. The atmosphere in the city is so much more positive. You can feel it, and it's brilliant.
And when it comes to January the 1st, 2018, when the City of Culture finishes...
Yeah, big question.
What happens next?
The big L, the big legacy. I am confident, as Hull 2017 team have said, that they were working on legacy, before day one. Nothing can be like this year. I think everyone knew that this year was special. You can't sustain it at this high level. It's been intense this year in many ways. This has been like a springboard this year for what's going to come next. We've got to continue with all the connections that have been made this year. So Hull 2017 had a fund called CCP that gave money to 60 organisations and groups and across the city to do creative activities this year. There's all that to build on. There's the volunteers that are all still here, still wanting to do stuff. So there's lots of things to build on. The businesses are saying that they've done really well this year. There's a lot to build on.
So to finish on, you think that our listeners should feel cheerful about the whole idea of a city of culture?
Reasons to be cheerful are definitely, I think every single city should be City of Culture at some point. I don't think it should be a competition. I think everybody should have a go at it because it has had a positive impact on this part of the world.
Sharon, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about the experience of Hull City of Culture.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Listening to all that is Dr. Dave O'Brien from the University of Edinburgh. And he thinks a lot about cultural issues, cultural regeneration, inequality. Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about what you think listening to Sharon. What's your reaction?
I thought that was wonderful. And what was really great about it was how she was telling a story of cultural success. I suppose what was maybe missing or maybe on the edges of what she was talking about was economic impact. So one of the really interesting things about Hull's year was when it was announced, the dominant story in the news was that jobs, inward investment, etc. would come. Whereas Sharon's story was one of a kind of brilliant series of cultural events, cultural programs, and I guess kind of changes to the physical infrastructure of her estate through culture as well. And that, I suppose, is the big tension that's come up with using culture for urban regeneration,
right,
between the stories that say, look, if you do this, you'll get, you know, all these kind of different new jobs replacing maybe factory jobs that have gone or whatever. And the idea that actually if we're going to have a cultural festival, let's just do arts and cultural things. That in turn has its own issues. There are issues about kind of who attends arts and cultural events, who doesn't, who's engaged and who isn't. But yeah, one of the kind of, I suppose, things that need more work doing is around the economic impact and being more cautious about, say, jobs and investment.
And what is the real story on the economic impact? Because one of the reasons we're featuring this on the podcast is because it's a great thing to celebrate. I think it builds a great sense of community, a sense of civic pride. And I think those things are incredibly important in themselves. And I think for me, it would justify it on its own. But what is the story on the economic impact?
So, I mean, you're totally correct. And it's almost a bit sad that we're not talking about, you know, civic pride being a great thing
sure,
to celebrate
sure.
just in of itself. We have a strange story of economic impact, partially because of the success of two British cities. So Glasgow in 1990, which was a European capital of culture, and then Liverpool in 2008, which was again a European capital of culture. The Liverpool story was of a massive success in terms of economic impact, and large figures such as kind of £800 million of economic impact are sort of in the public domain.
Are they true?
So they are broadly correct, yes, if you accept the assumptions of the models right. underpinning
sure,
them.
Sure, sure.
I won't get into that.
Sure.
The issue that myself and my colleagues, Peter Campbell and Samson Cox, have had as we've kind of been working on the story of Liverpool is that UK City of Culture has taken that and said, look, you know, if you put a pound in, you'll get £8 of economic impact back. And what we've been saying is that actually the Liverpool story is really specific because you have a story of a city that had this almost kind of unique cultural offer in terms of its museums, its musical heritage, its football clubs, and a comparatively low level of economic development to take advantage of that. So when I was growing up in the city, the hotel offer was almost kind of non-existent.
What about the Adelphi with the taps which run brown water?
I think that would be one example of what I'm talking about, as you know, as a underdevelopment of the service sector in the city. And similarly, actually, like shopping was quite poor in the city when I was growing up, and there are lots of kind of economic issues. This is one of the reasons that Merseyside as a whole was designated as a candidate for Objective 1 funding from the EU. So kind of around £1 billion came in two tranches in the period leading up to 2008.
So there were other things going on is basically what you're saying.
So many other things. And in the next few days, we're going to hear what the next UK city of culture is going to be. And whilst those candidate cities have got these kind of incredible local cultures that are fantastic, the extent to which they've got, I guess, a kind of a really global tourist offer that, you know, just needs kind of hotels and businesses to be built around them is maybe less so.
Is there an issue here about the way we think about regeneration led by culture? Because maybe we think about it as you build exciting things, people come from outside into an area, and then it sort of lifts the area up. There was this urbanist, I think Richard Florida, who said the best way to improve a decaying urban area was to open cool bars, creatives, techies, hipsters, and all that. And I think he's since gone back on some of that. But that feels like an uncomfortable way of thinking about it. It's what Grayson Perry was saying to us earlier. Is there a different way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I think what's really important is from your starting point is don't take somebody else's model and say, if we do that here, we'll get exactly the same results. And then don't set up a cultural project that almost from the start is deliberately designed to not involve local people and indeed kind of displace them or get rid of them. So, as you've identified, one of the big stories around urban regeneration through culture has been, if we could just get a completely different population, then, you know, our tax base would be better, our streets would be cleaner, we'd have, like, you know, less urban problems, etc. But that's both a crazy and really offensive way to think about local communities and local populations.
So where have they done a good job of that, and how have they done it?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. Londonderry was the first UK city of culture. And I think there's a lot to learn from there, actually, because although that similar tension between kind of economic impact narratives and cultural stories was present, actually, that was a place where the cultural activities, particularly in terms of community building, were really important for obvious, you know, kind of historical
And they
reasons.
Did it well, did they?
I think so, yeah, particularly in terms of developing cross-community relations. There were the kind of big moments of, say, you know, the Turner Prize being over there and stuff like that. But it presents quite a different model, I think, to the idea of, yeah, just build a new building and suddenly, you know, techies will flood in and start paying tax.
So is it like an either-or situation? So if you go big on engaging local community, you get the first thing we talked about, which was the sense of civic pride and all the sort of cuddly benefits. And if you go the other way and you think about tourism, then you get the economic benefits.
No, it shouldn't be. And part of the success, I think, of Liverpool was that they kind of did both at once. So there's something about the kind of say, musical history of the city that local people are just insanely proud of, even if there are kind of, you know, issues around, say, closures of venues and stuff like this. But it's also something tourists are really, really interested in. So a good example from Liverpool is the Museum of Liverpool, which has been incredibly successful, both in terms of getting the wider Merseyside population, many of whom are not your kind of usual suspects for going to a museum, but also appealing to tourists as well, who are interested in, football, music, broader kind of, Scouse culture.
I mean, I think there's the other sort of danger in this, which is that somehow, and I know you're not saying this, we sort of get into the idea of thinking, well, if you build cultural venues and so on, it's only going to be attractive to people from outside, when the opposite, it's just totally untrue. So we've got the Cast Theatre in Doncaster. It was relatively new, 4 or 5 years. It's a, it's partly about good public space, which is available to people, and, good public space and good things happening in it, in an area. And I think, it feels to me like there must be a sort of middle way here between the idea that it's sort of gentrification gone mad, displace existing communities, and the idea maybe that it's an alien thing coming from elsewhere. Good, this done well, surely must be able to engage existing communities as well as outside communities, as really what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really liked about what Sharon was saying was this idea that, like, everybody does culture. And so I guess the question is, if you're going to have, urban development, kind of infrastructure building and stuff, how do you do that in a way that kind of says, what about, appealing, maybe not to everybody because you can't please all of the people all of the time, but at least, meeting people where their interests are, rather than, I guess, when it's done badly, you've got, the idea of, if we put a theatre in and, we just put on, say, what the National Theatre are doing down in London, somehow that'll speak to the everyday life of, people in Birmingham, which, like, there are different cultures across the country, different cultural practices, different, kind of sets of interests. And they're what needs to be kind of foregrounded, even within these kind of maybe expensive infrastructure projects that need, sponsors and central government and this kind of thing to help.
You're saying there's got to be a connection to place. It can't just be something that's dropped in there.
Yeah, I mean, that's so, so crucial, particularly in terms of when the aims of a project are really explicit to transform a place. There is this question about, well, transforming for who, in what way, what's the kind of the end state, and how are you kind of bringing people who are often not just kind of culturally disengaged, but have, these broader issues around unemployment, education, etc. How are you bringing them to be central to making decisions rather than kind of imposing decisions upon them?
I mean, I suppose part of this, to state the obvious, but it probably is worth stating, is you can't use culture to try and answer all of the deep-seated problems or challenges, economic challenges of inequality and so on, that an area has. And if you try and load it all onto the cultural offer or the cultural undertaking, then you're not going to succeed.
No, absolutely not. And it's a bit unfair to, I guess, kind of expect organisations who are brilliant at certain things, like producing Shakespeare plays, to, create thousands of new jobs or, transform years of issues in the education system and stuff like this. So also, I guess, kind of, tempering expectations is quite important.
But also too, just at a fundamental level of equality, why should it be only people who live in London who have, at their fingertips these great cultural offers? I mean, I think that's for me, that's the sort of basic start, sort of baseline, which is why I think I support this. It's got to be done the right way. It's got to be done engaging the local community, but it shouldn't, it's partly just a choice question, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, we know the English cultural system is deeply unequal, both in terms of funding, which, gets kind of funneled through London because of the national institutions, but also kind of specific bits of funding. So the tension between who, by and large, is playing the lottery, for example, and who is benefiting from the arts organisations.
Right.
There's a real big disconnect between, say, the northeast of England, which has, some very rich cultural institutional offerings in, say, Newcastle, but, it's quite rural, it's quite dispersed, and then where the money is in London. On top of that, I think there's also a question about who is making culture. So we know London is crucial to cultural production in this country, And because of various reasons, but, you know, primarily things like the housing crisis, what we're finding is that in some research myself and colleagues from the LSE are doing, that people actually making culture tend to be from quite narrow social starting points, professional managerial background. You know, they tend to have come through particular educational institutions. And so they're quite different, actually, to the rest of the population that I guess they are hoping to, or are kind of thinking that they're serving. So one thing we might do, not just in terms of kind of transforming where money is going in terms of places, but transforming how culture is produced in terms of places to make cultural production more diverse.
So there's another, who has the opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. That's
and
so
that
so
does
crucial.
Go back to schools, doesn't it? And what is the cultural offer in schools? And I know there have been attempts, which this government has sort of resisted, to have a standard, I don't mean standard, but a sort of a good cultural offer in schools to young people. It's a certain number of hours of culture each week and so on. Is that right?
Yeah. And then also, I think, broadening out what we mean by culture. So it's not just a matter of kind of like, you know, sitting kids in front of, again, you know, a sort of a Shakespeare play, or, you know, a dry and dusty bit of English lit or whatever, but trying to transform how we think about, you know, say, cultural canons to be more open, more diverse. So what goes on at, say, GCSE level is reflective of the everyday lives of Britain's diverse population, particularly actually in the regions outside of London.
But that's why these cities of culture seem to be such a good thing, because if you're growing up in one of those towns, you're seeing people like me do this. It's not people down in London or people from 500 years ago. The more you see that people like me have the opportunity to do this, the more of a sort of bleed through effect that's going to have on kids and people from different backgrounds.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of cliche that's come out of big discussions in the States, you know, if you can't see it, you can't be it, you know, around, say, who is on stage, who's on screen in America, and then increasingly, like, who is backstage, you know, and off screen in terms of producing things. I guess I know reasons to be cheerful, and one, you know, what you just said is definitely a reason to be cheerful, but my caution, I guess, would be in terms of thinking about the broader barriers of getting in and getting on. A lot of these things are to do with kind of quite subtle sort of social networks, going to the right universities, you know. So again, we're back to Ed's point about don't kind of put everything onto culture for dealing with the kind of big social and economic issues in the country, but equally, like, don't kind of shy away from the idea that culture can do some really great stuff.
Just to end with a simplistic thought, you know, every place should be an exciting place to live. I mean, I think that's sort of, in a way, the basic, my basic thing.
Yeah.
You know, every place should have a sense of not just pride, but also there should be exciting things to do.
Yeah.
That, you know, in a way, it could be as simple as that.
Yeah, and but I think crucially it should be about that place. So, you know, not just the kind of like, you know, hey, this worked here, let's just copy it, but actually, what do we do? What does our place do? What are we good at? And what should we celebrate? Because that both, you know, will kind of create sustainable cultural legacies because people will own it. And also it'll produce kind of, you know, interesting and different cultural forms.
I've got one more question, which is maybe a bit unfair. If I made you Secretary of State for Culture tomorrow, and also maybe Chancellor of the Exchequer and Prime Minister at the same time, just in case you didn't have enough power, as somebody who knows about these issues, what would you do?
Radically reorientate funding away from London. London has amazing cultural institutions. It's really important that they're funded, but I think there are different business models that many of the bigger London institutions could use. And actually a lot of the money might be, I suppose you could argue, you know, less effectively spent outside of London in terms of, say, visitor numbers, but actually much more effectively spent in terms of transforming places.
Dave, thanks so much for joining us. So, Jeff, what do you think about all of that?
I mean, I think it has been... The whole conversation has been something to be cheerful about. And I don't want to be too Pollyanna-ish just because I know there are issues around gentrification with some cultural programs sometime. But just broadly speaking, I remember being a kid and feeling like this stuff wasn't for me. And then because of... I grew up just outside Manchester. Because of efforts of Manchester as a city and of individuals like Tony Wilson from Factory Records... They give you a sense of possibility, and not just of getting out, but staying somewhere and being involved in creative things. And it just changes your way of thinking about stuff.
We can talk a lot about what is the impact on regeneration and so on, and that's got, you've got to get that right. But fundamentally, I think it comes down to just something very basic, which is people's right to see, do exciting stuff, and, you know, it not just to be restricted to some people. But it's sort of bringing culture, and I think Grayson was brilliant, but he's so right about this, which is, you know, culture is a very loaded word, and it does sometimes sound like something you're doing to people, and culture should be, I think the distinction between high and low culture is false, and it should be broad. But bringing a range of cultural experiences to people has got to be a good thing.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
If you've got thoughts about what you've heard today about culture or ideas for future shows, keep those emails coming in. You can find us on Twitter at Cheerful Podcast, or you can email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com, or go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. Right, we've had an email from Matthew Horn. Subject, simple-ish solution to UK tax. Hello, Jeff and Ed, the new Jedward Gedward. Thanks for your enlightening. It's good. It'll catch on. Thanks for your enlightening podcasts. I've long been an advocate for simplifying the UK tax rules to stop tax avoidance. The main concern for me is that when you have one tax at a high rate, e.g. PAYE, National Insurance on Earnings, and another low tax rate, for example, capital gains tax, just 10%, you can end up with people shifting income into capital schemes to pay at the lower rate. We discussed this last week. It's near impossible for HMRC to prevent this happening. The solution, as far as I can tell, is to have a single UK rate of tax for all taxes. I would scrap national insurance contributions, which is particularly unfair on employees, and set the same rate for income tax, capital gains tax, and corporation tax. I would not increase this rate as you earn more, but have it set at a single figure for the year. Now, I don't... I think he's sort of got something going for what he's saying, Matthew, but I'm... This is a sort of flat tax.
You hear
really,
libertarians talking about flat tax quite a lot, don't you?
You do. I mean, his defence of it, just to say, is that he says if the tax rate increases the more you earn, the more likely the income is to be deferred to a later time or converted into capital, resulting in less tax being collected. I mean, I'm not sure I buy that argument. And look, the case for progressive taxation is that those with the broadest shoulders should bear the greatest burden, and not just in sort of absolute terms, but as a percentage of their income. Now, actually, when you look at the figures for the UK tax system, I mean, this is almost unbelievable, but I think I'm right in saying that the bottom 20% pay as much, if not more, as a percentage of their income than the top 20%.
Wow.
Because of the indirect taxes, because of VAT, which, you know, bears more heavily on the poorest tax because on. They pay more of a proportion of their income on goods that have VAT on them. So I think that principle of the progressive tax system is a really important one. But I think his other point about capital gains tax and so on is important. Now, off the subject of tax, we have an email from Kevin Houghton. That's H-O-U-G-H-T-O-N.
I think that's Houghton.
Right.
What do you mean, right? Just to give you some background here, there has been an extensive discussion before we switched the microphone on about whether it's Houghton or Houghton.
Perhaps we can just sort of split the difference and sort of agree to disagree and say both ways are right. Okay.
Yeah.
We can both have prizes on this one. Right. Now, Kevin.
Yeah, that was you dealt with that very well.
Took it in my stride.
Cross party lines.
Yeah, exactly. I reached across the aisle, as they say in the United States. Right, subject. This is Kevin who emailed, not Kevin the cat, who was earlier on named Grayson Berry. Grayson's cat is amazing, but he doesn't email in and he's not called Kevin Houghton either. Right.
Houghton.
Houghton. Right. So Kevin Houghton emails in and says, listening to your podcast makes me sad, .. that you didn't win the election. I'd much prefer someone... Now, I thought this was a compliment and I've now worked out it isn't. I'd much prefer someone who is incompetent with a bacon sandwich than a group of people who are just plain old incompetent.
That's still a compliment. I mean, there's a little dig in there, but it's still a compliment, right?
He says incompetent with a bacon sandwich.
Nobody's arguing that you're competent with a bacon sandwich.
Oh, incompetent with a bacon sandwich.
Yes.
No, I see.
Not incompetent, it's comma, the Oxford with a comma. Bacon sandwich.
It's the Oxford comma. Is it an Oxford comma?
No, not, it's a different type of comma.
It's not. The Oxford comma is different. Yeah. But anyway, sorry, I read it slightly the wrong way, Kevin. I'd much prefer someone who's incompetent with a bacon sandwich than a group who are just plain old incompetent with a bacon sandwich.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay. Now that we've got that out of the way, his point is kind of related to the universal basic income. I'm a big fan of Star Trek, but one aspect of Star Trek really boggles my brain, and that is that in the Star Trek universe, they don't have money. At first, I thought this would never work. It's all very fine not paying the captain. After all, who wouldn't want to be Captain Kirk? But what about the guy who cleans the Enterprise's toilets? Never featured that on the show, I don't think. How do you motivate him to go to work? But then after a particularly boring work YouTube conference, brackets my company trying to be modern and techie, I hope we're not going to get him fired for this, the autoplay feature served up an interesting...
He can always say, oh no, that wasn't me, that was Kevin Houghton.
Yeah, exactly. You've given him his defense. The autoplay feature served up an interesting article on motivation. Now, let's just say, listeners, that... Kevin then referred us to this YouTube video, and Jeff and I were a bit like, are we going to bother to watch this YouTube video? Maybe we're not going to read out his comment. If we don't watch the YouTube video, we can't read out his comment. He mentioned a phallic candle in the thing, and maybe that sort of titillated Jeff a little bit, and so he thought let's watch the YouTube video. Anyway, this YouTube video is bloody brilliant, Kevin Houghton.
It's so great.
I honestly really recommend this YouTube video.
It's a TED Talk, and we almost don't want to spoil it for you, we'll put the link up on the Facebook page, and I guess we'll tweet it as well.
The guy's name is Dan Pink,
and the talk is called The Puzzle of Motivation, and it's so good, and it's challenges the orthodoxy.
I mean, basically we took an 18 minute break from recording this podcast because we were so gripped by this by this TED Talk. And his basic point is, it's just get your head around this. They did this experiment which required some creativity with some students or something. And the one group was told, you've got to do this, so the so-called candle experiment. You've got to do this thing. You've got to make sure that you're in a room and you've got to make sure that the candle is, you're given a candle and a box of some... shut up. You're given a candle with... I'm trying to explain this. You're given a candle with a box and some pins, and you've got to somehow stop the candle, light the candle with some matches, and stop the candle wax going on the table.
It's a logic puzzle about attaching...
Oh, God, okay, you explain it then.
It's a logic puzzle about attaching a candle to a wall. And the idea behind it is that people who were given a financial motivation did worse than the people who weren't given a financial motivation. It's basically saying that if a task is challenging and engaging, then that can be motivation enough in its own merit, right?
Well, not just can be. I mean, that actually you do better.
Yeah.
Without the financial motivation, which is very, very counterintuitive.
Mm.
And his whole point is that 21st century tasks require such a large degree of creativity that actually the whole business model needs to be rethought. And if you think about it, it has huge implications for public services, business, and a whole range of things. And it's a very, very good talk.
It is a very good talk. I'm not quite sure how it solves the problem of the toilet on the Starship Enterprise. But maybe that is a task that would require ingenuity if William Shatner's been... been on there. I don't know. It looks like a man who could leave a mess. That's all I'm saying.
Is that like a... I thought you were making some kind of Shatner pun. I thought it was a sort of bad Shatner pun.
No, that was you.
Right, over to you, and it's an easy one to pronounce, so that's quite good.
This is Catherine Bird, who says, "Hi, Jeff and Ed. I have another Ed Miliband anecdote, which again wasn't the most agreeable meeting, but instead of just writing to you to have a moan about it, I have an interesting suggestion for a resolution related to episode 6, which is the drugs episode. I met Ed Miliband just after the general election in 2015 while I was working at the Science Museum in London. I was manning the Typhoon Force flight simulator in the fly zone, which is notoriously busy on the weekends, and there's often a sea of hyper children and their parents. The atmosphere is quite intense, and it's often very loud. If you're over the age of 10, it's a stressful environment to be in. Anyway, to get a ride on the Typhoon Force, you have to purchase a ticket from the ticket desk, which is on the other side of the fly zone, meaning you have to go and queue up there and then come back to queue up for the ride itself. Ed came up to me to inquire about the ride and whether it would be suitable for his children. I explained the ride, probably not very well, because I was thinking, holy shit, that's Ed Miliband. And then I told him that he'd have to go and buy a ticket first. Ed, I can't remember exactly what your response was, but you weren't very pleased, and it must not have been great because your wife actually came and apologised to
you. Fake news. Fake news. Fake news. It's fake news.
She apologised.
It's fake news. It's crooked media. This is crooked media. I'm channeling Donald Trump. It's crooked media. Fake news. You can't believe these people. They just lie. They just lie. They're just liars. We should lock them up.
Yeah.
We should lock them up. I fired her. I fired her.
Why would you be in a grumpy mood just after the 2015 election?
I fired her.
I find that very difficult to believe. She says, "Don't worry, I didn't let it change my high opinion of you."
And whenever Fake news. Whenever
I've retold the story, I've given the context of a Tory Briton as a way not to besmirch your name.
Fake news.
With that said, there is a way that you can make this up to me. Yeah, he wants you jailed. That's the way he wants to make it up to you.
What? Exactly, lock her up.
With regards to episode 6, she tells us about a study. She's doing a master's at UCL, and basically they are looking for people to take part in a study about the effects of cannabis. Now, she says this isn't UCL saying, "Hey man, let's get high," but rather, "Hey man, let's do some research about how getting high affects your brain." So they're looking for people aged 16 to 19 and people aged 25 to 27 who do and do not currently use cannabis. They're going to be reimbursed £240 in total for their time. And your participation would be completely confidential. You're free to pull out at any time. There's an email address here, pals.canteenstudy. Now, canteen has a double N in this email address. pals.canteenstudy@ucl.ac.uk. Or if it's easier for you, there's a phone number, 0203 108 3319. And I think you're just slightly outside the age bracket, so you won't be able to sort of take part and get mellow with Catherine and try and repair some of the damage done. What were you glaring at me for telling people you're over the age of 27?
Well, the trouble was I was going to make that joke about you and you got in there first. So I felt slightly irritated by the whole fake news anyway. I mean, it's probably not even cannabis. It's probably not even a drug study. She's lying. Lock her up.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
And joining us to pitch ideas, which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, Helen Monks. Hello.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, we're excited to have you here, but you basically said that my loft is a disappointment to you.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I just had such an image of where you guys were sitting. Can you
describe what you saw in your mind's eye?
So in my mind's eye, it was quite a big, wide, white, lofty, and you were both sat in armchairs, quite far away from each other. But in reality, it's a tiny little, no offence, sort of very low-ceilinged, and you're both sat very intimately.
We like the intimacy.
I'm sorry to disappoint you.
No. If anything, it's brought me back down to earth. I'm quite happy. I was worried I was going to feel overwhelmed because I'm a big fan of the show.
Oh,
actually,
thank you.
I feel quite at home. This is a bit like where
that's
I live.
Good. You've brought some ideas with you, Helen. What's the first thing you've got?
I have, yeah. So my first idea is compulsory conversation on your commute. I'm quite known in my family for whenever I get on a train or a bus, people talking to me, and it's always a bit annoying.
I love this idea.
Yeah, so
I'm getting very tense at the very thought
of
it.
I love this idea.
Yeah, I'm so pleased because it's really annoying when it happens, but then afterwards you actually realise you've learned loads about other people.
Totally.
That you would never normally meet in real life.
I totally agree with
you. I've met people like coming off the train who have just come out of prison and are going back home, or particularly during Brexit, I met a lot of people who were voting to leave and understood a lot more like where they were coming from and wasn't that surprised, therefore, by like the result. Because
and how do you start the conversation?
Well, see, I don't. They always come up to me. But in this world where it's a policy, it is, you have to, it's the law. And I almost think we should do like seating
yes,
plans.
Yes, this is my favourite idea
oh,
so
yeah.
far.
This is a nightmare yes. to me.
This is definitely what we need. Honestly, it will make the world a much better place, trust me.
This sounds like one of those wedding receptions where they force you to sit next to people you don't know to get...
No, it's exactly like that. And it's probably
but
horrendous.
Why did they come up... But
So me, I don't know.
You've got one of those faces, you
I've
look
got
friendly.
One of those faces. But also, I was with my mum the other day because I said, it's so annoying, people always come up to me. And then she pointed out after someone had come over and spoken to us that it's because I invite it, really. I go, oh, I like your bike. And then they talk to me
exactly.
at great length about their bike. So it probably is me, actually.
But I think you're... But, you know, it's really interesting, isn't it? This is you're obviously an extrovert. Yes.
Oh, do you think? Oh, God, no. Am
no,
I?
No, an extrovert is somebody who is energised by the company of other people.
Maybe.
An introvert is somebody who's drained by
but,
it.
I mean, see, isn't it? Because my wife and I have exactly this conversation. I love talking to people. I had this riotous thing on coach C on the train coming back from my constituency. I talked to all these people and apparently the whole carriage were involved in this conversation.
That's
and it was just great. My mother always used to say to me, are you going to be a boy to go tiger shooting with? And what she meant by that, not that she shot tigers.
One of Donald Trump's sons.
No, but what she meant was, are you going to be like adventurous? And I think good things, and this is what we talk to our kids about a lot, and I've sort of persuaded my wife this.
She'd want you to be the tiger shooting type.
Yeah, because it's like good things happen to people who are adventurous, because you meet interesting people, you form friendships with people, whereas if you're sort of stick in the mud and sort of hang back, you just miss out on lots of life's experiences.
Maybe this is my problem. This
yeah.
has made me been miserable all these decades.
You've been stuck in your attic too long,
yes.
using your toilet.
Yes.
Having a great time, though.
How do we enforce it, though?
Oh, you have to.
Cultural.
I don't know. I'm almost a bit like state heavy-handed. You should get people on seating plans, sitting next to people they wouldn't normally speak to.
Conversation inspectors.
Yeah.
Who could like walk up and down the carriage and
yeah.
say, excuse me, you don't seem to have started a conversation. Do you know each other? If you don't know each other, you've got to start a conversation.
Yeah, I love how enthusiastic you are about
this. Totally
this will be me never leaving the house.
I think you would
or walking everywhere.
But why?
Because I feel so drained. Like, I get terribly anxious about not having anything to say. And
just ask questions, I think.
But that's what I do anyway. That's what I do to avoid talking about myself.
But you're incredibly engaging as a person.
Oh, thank you.
No, but you are, seriously.
The eye contact is happening again.
But you know what it's like. So you say Justine is the same way.
Yes, she
so
doesn't.
Some people just, you know, it's almost like two mental genders, isn't it? And some of us.
I had these people sitting opposite me on
thing.
The tube the other day, and she was with me, and she hates it when I get into these conversations. And but partly because it's sort of like the people seem to want to talk to me, and then she feels a bit sort of like what she's supposed
spare
to do.
Yeah. So I feel like maximum 8% of the conversations I have are great conversations.
8%.
8%.
8%. Who are you talking to?
I'm trying to avoid talking to people, and even. Even in that scenario,
you learn so much from people. I'm sorry to sound like an evangelist here, but
I'm learning boring things from people. But I think it's maybe my small talk is bad.
Maybe that's it. Maybe there should be a ban on small talk. Oh, mind you, that'd be exhausting then, wouldn't it? If we were just talking about.
So, do you believe in God then?
Oh God!
Yeah. But I think in a world where people are I could go on about this for hours.
A disconnected world.
In a world where people live in silos and don't really connect to each other and, you know, tend to connect with their own tribes, I think those kind of conversations are really important.
Yeah, and actually the conversations that you have, sometimes they don't change your mind in the moment or whatever, but they can stick with you much longer than you realise about.
When I came back from Australia, I when I was had lost the election, went to Australia.
You lost the election?
I heard you went to Ibiza.
I did go to Ibiza. And in fact...
You can't remember anything.
Oh, God, it's such a digression, this. But basically, the Times did this mock-up of me dancing topless in Ibiza.
Yeah, we all saw it.
And the mother of a friend of somebody who worked for me, actually, said to him, "Oh, it's so good. I saw those pictures of it. It's so good. He's having a nice time and letting his hair down." But anyway, the thing I was going to say about Australia was I was walking, it was 2 days after I got back, I was kept out of the leadership contest, Jeremy Corbyn and so on, met a guy on the street, didn't know him, he's since become a friend of mine. He stopped me and said, "Oh," it said, "Miliband, how funny, I've got my Labour Party ballot paper in my hand and I'm going back to go and vote for Jeremy Corbyn." And I started saying to him, "Well, why are you voting for Jeremy Corbyn?" He said, "Oh, I couldn't forgive myself if I didn't." He explained to me he'd been to a rally. And, you know, I kind of learned what people were thinking and feeling in that moment. And he's since become my friend. And it would never have happened, well, if he hadn't recognised me. But if I hadn't sort of stopped to talk to him, I could have just said, "Oh, you know, I'm busy with my kids. You know, I don't want to talk to you," or something.
This is amazing. You're now friends with somebody who just came up to you in the street.
That happens all the time. Yeah, one of my best friends now is a woman I met in the toilet. She'd seen me in a telly show and she'd really enjoyed it, so she waited outside to tell me she'd really liked it. And then she turned out to be one of the most amazing people ever. And then she came to visit the set of the thing that she liked, and now we're really good friends.
Wow.
But, you know, for the times that does happen, about 10 times when you meet someone who is a bit insufferable.
I think Helen's right. Look, I think it gives you a positive view about human nature because you realise that most people are actually very, very nice.
That's
so
true.
So I was going for a walk in the countryside with my wife once, and we got really lost, and we ended up at this sort of place, and we were walking by a canal. And we ended up, and we've become friends with these, very good friends with these people. And it turned out they ran an art gallery kind of in the middle of like a small village. And we sort of, you know, knocked on the door because we were lost and it was raining. And then they invited us in and da-da-da-da-da.
That's so nice.
Yeah. Jeff's looking sort of stunned.
I've got faith
theory in... Theory of gravity.
I've got faith in humanity. I believe that humanity is ultimately good. I could just do without interacting with individual humans.
Well, I think it is an introvert-extrovert thing, isn't it?
But also it's not true, because I think that's, you know, how your friendship with Ed started, was reaching out.
Exactly.
And also you run a podcast where your whole thing is like talking to people.
In a very controlled environment.
Where
in
they then
loft.
Leave.
Yeah. Helen, what's your next idea?
Well, keen to move on, aren't you?
Stop talking. Also, you say 8% of conversations are good.
Maximum.
So what about this? What's happening right now with this conversation? Are we in your 8%?
Yeah, you're in the 8%.
We're in the 92.
We
are the 92,
Helen. We are the
92.
We can set up a tent in the garden.
It's a carefully curated conversation.
We're going to have a T-shirts made. We are the 92.
What's your next idea, Helen?
So my next kind of leads on. I didn't really realise when I was writing it, but the idea of empathy politics. So you're allowed to say whatever you want and you're allowed to come up with whatever policies you want, but you always have to have first-hand experience of the thing that you're doing. So, like, you're allowed to cut benefits, but you then have to live on benefits. And equally, you're allowed to...
Honestly, you should be in politics. Honestly, mate, you should be in politics. That is, like, you're totally right about this. Carry on, sorry.
Well, just, like, things like Katie Hopkins is allowed to do a hate blog about refugees, but she then has to be a refugee. I think that, yeah, that was it, really. That's my whole thing.
Because Obama did this speech once, which really, I really remember this, saying that our real problem in politics is an empathy deficit. And it is, I think it is so true. And you know, the funny thing was... I once got really into thinking about this and thinking about, you know, isn't empathy the key to leadership? And there's also this study that some academics did showing that the more power you have, the less empathetic you become. Like, it's a brain thing.
Wow. Because you relate to people less.
You relate, or right. You relate to people less. I can't remember exactly. We'll find the study and we'll post it on our Facebook page. But the But so I think you're completely right. And I think there's something about politics that makes people less empathetic, because it does, you know, you have lots of people around you, power, the trappings of power and so on.
But you see it all the time, like homophobic people who don't like gay people apart from Brian next door, who's a laugh. Like, and it's so true that that as soon as you kind of meet people on a human level, it's really difficult to enforce policy or to hate them or whatever.
It's really interesting this, because when phone hacking happened, Harriet Harman was our... culture, media and sport spokesperson. And I remember her saying to me, it was around the Leveson inquiry and so on, she said, "Look, it's incredibly important that we walk in the victim's shoes." And I always remember that her using that phrase. And actually then Cameron used that phrase. He said, if it isn't right by the victims, it won't be all right for me. And of course, he then reneged on it. But you know, I think it's such an important thing because how do you govern a country or decide on things if you can't put yourself in the position of the people it's affecting? And you can't live that life.
But that was. That
but
was,
you can.
You can give it to someone else.
But you can. You can sort of imagine what that life would be like, or go and find out about it.
But that was the whole thing, especially with those guys, sort of Cameron and Osborne. They seemed very removed.
Hug a hoodie.
Yeah. How long did that last, though?
But honestly, I remember that hug a hoodie thing, and I remember when I was leader. And it was when the riots happened, and I never found a way of doing this. And Cameron was not good in his response to the riots. But I remember wanting to go to him and say, "Listen, you know, just privately, your hug a hoodie speech was a good speech. It was an important thing that he was saying." And then he sort of went off it. And you know, there were, I know this is kind of controversial for some people, there were good parts to Cameron's agenda when he was leader of the opposition. You know, about understanding more, all of that stuff that he said.
But then it just felt like they were pretending to be like that until they got elected and then they went back to their old ways.
Putting empathy back into public life, really important.
Mm.
And did you have another one, Helen?
Yeah, my final one is that I think that tea should be free everywhere, in all pubs, cafes, restaurants, gyms, theatres.
On the tube.
When you
have part of the conversation.
That's a great one.
Ed, a man as physically inept as you are shouldn't be advocating free hot beverages on moving public transport.
Listen, you're in no position to talk honey bun.
What's your rationale?
I just think tea makes the world better. Mm-hmm. Also, particularly in England, like so many people drink it and we spend so much money on it. But also, it's kind of symbolic of costing up. Like, it's always the thing that places make the most money on because it's the cheapest to make. So I just think ideologically...
Never mind free 4G on the tube. You should have free tea on
free
the tube.
Free tea. Yeah. I spend so much money in Pret, it's why I can't afford a house.
Well, that's what they say about millennials,
exactly.
Isn't it?
So. I read that and I was like, do you know what? There is an element of truth. I do buy a lot of cups of tea in Pret.
I don't think it's enough for a house.
Yeah, I don't know if it would stretch to a deposit.
Yeah,
to free tea. So where else apart from the tube did you say?
So theatres, gyms, cafes, restaurants, any kind of eatery, libraries. I just think there should just be tea on tap all the time.
But there is a kind of pattern here, which is how do you encourage a sort of sense of community and reaching out for people?
Yeah, that's true, because tea
empathy,
would encourage...
Empathy, conversations.
I'm definitely into free tea. I'm struggling a little bit with the compulsory
with
small
the empathy.
Talk. But
with
the, yeah. Helen, what can people see you in at the moment? Anything?
In bed. I've got a couple of things. I'm not sure what's official, but a couple of things in the can that are going to be on telly next year. So maybe just follow me on the old Twitter.
And you are at Helen_Monks.
Yeah. And I run a theatre company called Lung Theatre, and we've got a few plays coming up as well. So.
Fantastic. It's been great to have you. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed it.
You could go and see one of Helen's productions with Presentjit.
Yes. There was a guy who said I was rude to him at the theatre.
Yeah,
and we've been looking for an opportunity for Ed to be able to make amends.
Maybe I'll go with you instead, okay. Jeff.
Oh, come along, please.
Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So thanks to Grayson Perry, who I thought was excellent, Sharon Darley from the Goodwin Trust in Hull, Dave O'Brien from the University of Edinburgh, all of them were great, and also Helen Monks, who I absolutely loved. I thought she was brilliant.
You're doing a great job with these thank yous. What about thanking the team too?
Yeah, no. I'd like to thank Emma Corsham, who produced the show.
Wonderful job.
And does
she
so brilliantly. And she's so diligent and brilliant and excellent.
She does such a great job of editing. You might think, this is edited. Yeah. This is the good stuff that they leave in. But
honestly,
she has
to deal with all kinds of ridiculous comments coming from me and you and everybody else.
The dreck that she has to take
the dreck,
out.
Yeah. I'd like to thank Alex Feist-Bryce for his excellent research and backup, and Lindsay Todd.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some other thank yous.
Well, I was wondering if you'd like to thank our announcer.
Yeah, I'd like to thank our announcer, Gail Lofthouse.
And what about the fellow who put the idents together?
Ed Seed.
That's James Deacon.
And
then the composer of our music.
Ed Seed.
And who designed our artwork? You don't know, do you? Emily Power,
of course.
How
I was
could
just,
you forget?
I didn't want you to feel excluded by not doing your name. That's why I left the dead air.
Talk about cock and bull
stories. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we recommend that you now go off and talk to some strangers on public transport, according to Helen's suggestion.
Well, I do that anyway, actually. Oh, I'm going to go and see your balcony people, actually.
Oh, of course. Yeah, they're waiting for you.
I've got my appointment on the balcony. I might never return.
So we're done. Don't forget, if you want to email us, it's reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Christmas is coming up.
Follow us on...
How's your Christmas shopping going?
It's not.
I just want it to end.
Well, listen, what did I tell you about the first
round of
show business?
Oh, I had an amazing Christmas story, right?
Okay.
Oh, this is amazing. And so, do you know the NORAD Santa tracker?
I'm familiar with it.
Right, so NORAD, which I think is something to do with NASA or the US Defense Department, I think it's more the US Defense Department, has this Santa tracker where kids on between Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, as Christmas Day arrives in different places, Australia and so on, Australia's obviously first, you can watch the presents being delivered on Christmas Eve and so on, and you can track Santa all around the globe. And I was just reading an article the other day about how this had happened, and there's this mythology that what it was that a number in like 1955 got printed in the newspaper for some Santa something or other, and this little kid rang up the US Defense Department instead, and they suddenly had a bright idea. And I don't think that's sort of 100% true, but I think there's a sort of germ of truth. And it was a sort of PR exercise by the US Defense Department, which began as, we're keeping Santa safe during the Cold War.
Wow.
So we're sort of protecting Santa.
From the commies.
Protecting Santa from the commies. I mean, it's quite effective, isn't it?
That's incredible.
I mean, I'm sure that Eugene is going to get into the Santa tracker at some point.
I think so. And what a history I'll be able to tell him about there.
I mean, I think it does sort of brings home the fact that he's delivering sort of, you know, 20 billion presents, yeah, you know, which is sort of feels slightly.
But let's use your expression here that you use a lot of the time when the microphones aren't on. Let's not get stuck.
In the weeds.
In the weeds. Zed's big expression at the moment.
No, that's not.
It's a big buzz phrase.
Let's not get stuck. It was actually last year's, but...
Oh, sorry. Right, and I know you've got your appointment with the balcony, guys, so I've been Jeff... No, I know you've got your appointment with the balcony, guys, so I'm going to let you go.
No, I don't think you get to, like, edit that out and, like, redo it. I think that's staying in, Matey Popeye. I mean, you know...
Matey Popeye! This is another Edism. Where do you get these things from? All right, he's been Matey Popeye.
He's been the guy with the two-toned shoes.
And these have been Reasons to be Cheerful. And thanks to Kevin Horton for the email. Bye.